Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Bring in show music, please.
This is Squawk Pod. I'm CNBC producer Katie Kramer. Today on our podcast, the spread and severity of the Omicron variant of COVID-19 with former FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb.
There's a lot of people who are going to get infected with Delta even still, and they may find that that immunity that they've acquired through that Delta infection isn't going to be protective against Omicron.
Digital media company BuzzFeed is now public. More than listicles and quizzes, CEO Jonah Peretti.
If you want to think about what we're looking for in the future, it's really strong brands, really engaged audiences, great new monetization opportunities, and the ability to have more operating leverage as a bigger company with some shared services.
Plus, Ray Dalio clarifies his comments on China that were only on Squawk Box and Bitcoin's volatile weekend.
You can get 50% moves in this thing.
It's Monday, December 6th, 2021. Squawk Pod begins right now.
Stand Becky by in 3, 2, 1, cue, please.
Good Monday morning, everybody. Welcome to Squawk Box right here on CNBC. I'm Becky Quick, along with Joe Kernan and Andrew Ross Sorkin. And this morning, we're looking at a mixed picture.
First up on our podcast, Bitcoin under pressure today after a wild weekend during which the cryptocurrency plunged as much as 17%. A single Bitcoin fell as low as about $43,000 on Saturday, down from Friday's close of $57,000. But not to fear, some are buying the dip. Over the weekend, El Salvador's president, Nayib Bukele, acquired an additional 150 Bitcoin after buying 100 coins just last week to take advantage of the currency weakening. In September, El Salvador became the world's first nation to adopt Bitcoin as legal tender, and just last week announced plans to create an oceanside Bitcoin city at the base of a volcano inspired by Alexander the Great. Here's Joe Kernan.
We say it got to 43. I think it got... I had a print at one point on one of my services, like 41. But anyway, 42 I've seen everywhere. The price of Bitcoin plunged. That's a pretty big move from 65 to 42. You can get 50% moves in this thing, down and up. It was 28,000 not that long ago, remember? And then went back to 65. Yep. Anyway, strategist Matt Malley at Miller Tabak told CNBC, it looks like somebody got hit with a margin call yesterday and was forced to sell. And they're talking about really derivatives based on Bitcoin that are leveraged, and that, you know, you can have some type of relationship to Bitcoin futures, ramp up the leverage, and small moves get you a big return. If it goes the other way, you get a margin call, and then you got to liquidate. He also noted that Bitcoin market tends to be more thin on weekends, so that probably made things worse. But it's really about the Fed too, and it's about speculative assets. If interest rates go up because the Fed tapers or even tightens at some point, just anything speculative becomes right. Less. It's just a knee-jerk kind
but
of reaction.
But Joe, you were saying you thought it was these other instruments. My understanding is that outside of the U.S., you can get leverage on certain sites up to like 100 times just straight up on Bitcoin, no?
On Bitcoin itself. That would make more sense, yeah. Because unless the tail's really wagging the dog you probably can leverage too. It's volatile. And these are, you know, we're talking about multiple Bs. I don't know if we hit Ts, but we could hit T at some
How
point.
How thinly traded is it? I mean, for it to be able to be a thin traded market to make that sort of exacerbation, I mean, that's...
But the total, I mean, the total market is, I think of crypto as like one of the major tech stocks, right? Yeah. It's about this, it's somewhere around there. Like, so still not that big of a market. And then you've got the people that will never sell. And then you've got some people that bought recently, I think. And they were all up briefly. But now think if you bought at 55, 60, 65, start getting that dry throat, that tight feeling, and because it can really move. Other cryptos right now, Ether also, I read a couple of times last week, it was outperforming Bitcoin. Well, not for long. It's tough to be a stacker, don't you think? if you bought, because stackers, a lot of stackers bought at 5, 6, 7, 8, 10, 12. Can you really, like, save up $50,000 to buy on what? I guess they do. They buy $50,000.
Well,
I'm thinking of myself.
Most people are just buying an
incremental.
I would have trouble buying
at this low. I mean, if you bought it, I think I bought it as low as $4,900 or $4,500 or something. I'm afraid.
But,
I mean, I took a lot
Andrew's
of profits.
Right.
I'm afraid to go back in. I'm not
things.
Giving
not
back my profit. Yeah. I'm not a holder. I guess I'm not a stacker. I'm not a giga stacker. Maybe I should be. Because when
You're
it goes back up, I always
either.
Say, huh?
You're not diamond hands either.
No, I'm definitely not. I've got maybe, what do I got? I got maybe a third of what I had initially. But
I wouldn't call you paper hands, though.
No, I'm not quite paper. I'm letting it ride now. You know, whatever happens, happens.
Bridgewater Associates founder Ray Dalio is speaking out over the weekend to try to clarify some of the comments he made last week on Squawk Box about China's record on human rights and specifically the government, quote, disappearing people.
Into the policy of disappearing people. I'll give a little bit of a perspective of that. Okay. What they have is an autocratic system. One of the leaders described it. He said that the United States is a country of individuals and individualism. And that's what it's about. He said in China, it's an extension of the family. He said, if you look at the word country in China, it consists of two characters, state, family. And that has to do with Confucian. And it's very much a top down. And as a top down country, what they're doing is that it's that kind of like a strict parent. They behave like a strict parent.
Here's what Dalio said on LinkedIn over the weekend. He said, quote, I didn't mean to convey that human rights aren't important because I certainly believe they are. And I didn't mean to convey that the U.S. and China deal with these issues similarly because they certainly don't. I was attempting to explain what a Chinese leader told me about how they think about governing. I was not expressing my own opinion or endorsing that approach. My overriding objective is to help understanding. Understanding and agreeing are two different things. And that's what was lost in the interview. I'm sorry my answer lacked that nuance and caused confusion. It also caused a lot of criticism and in certain cases piling on. Mitt Romney taking to Twitter, calling his friend, saying or describing his friend, describing Ray Dalio as his friend and also, quote, brilliant, but then saying that the comment was effectively a moral lapse. But there has been quite some consternation. The other piece of consternation that's happened as a result of this is inside Bridgewater itself, because the company's company's president, Devin McCormick, is perhaps set to maybe make a run at the Senate as a Republican in Pennsylvania. And that has caused, according to some reporting, its own disconnect inside the firm over this issue and whether his comments could be used effectively against McCormick. So lots to unpack and lots going on there.
Yep. Dr. Oz. Dr. Oz. Dr. Oz
also running there. Yeah.
Jersey's pretty close. I'm thinking I might, I probably won't. Not this time around, but I probably won't throw my
I was going to say, the two things that are fascinating to me about Dalio's comments, one is it is worth noting, and I think in fairness, worth saying, and I don't know if it's in fairness, but in disclosure for the purpose of Bridgewater, they have an enormous amount of money from the Chinese in their fund. And obviously that, plays in all of this.
That might make a difference. Yeah, well, I think we figured that. I like what he said, I'm not an expert. After telling us, I mean, you just heard him pontificating again about everything he knows about China and then asking about genocide or Uyghurs. Right. And he goes, oh, yeah, I'm not an expert.
The notion of whatever they're doing in terms of calling in people and then behaving in a certain way, that's their approach. If I picked that, evaluated all approaches around the world, in all countries, I'd be in a bind to try to find out, you know, where do I invest and so on. It's just not my domain, and I'll leave it to the government to make those decisions. And that's my basic approach.
I didn't really believe what he was saying, that he believed what he was saying. I will generously say that I think that he really, that the way he was describing it was the way he, was what he now in this clarification says that he was trying to do, which was to say, this is how I think they think about it. I'm not sure this is actually how he thinks about it, but I'm sure that'll be up for debate.
I've argued both sides, Andrew. When you decided not to go to Saudi Arabia, I said, well, come on, we're not going to use oil. So we all have to make decisions as a country on where we draw the line. And a lot of times you just can't draw the line necessarily when there's so much going on. If you took the moral high ground on every single situation in multinational relations, I don't know what the world would look like.
It'd be impossible. But where do you come down on the diplomatic boycott of the Olympics?
I know. And I'm really looking forward to the Olympics.
Me too.
So I just wish China would be nice. Stop the genocide. Stop the disappearing. Don't hold your breath.
All right. To listen to our full interview with Ray Dalio on China and his new book on the rise and fall of economic empires, check out our podcast published on November 30th. If you follow us on Apple Podcasts or subscribe on Spotify, you should see it right in your feed. Coming up on Squawk Pod today, more states across the U.S. reporting cases of the Omicron COVID variant. Former FDA Commissioner Dr. Scott Gottlieb on the rising concern.
I worry about states that have low vaccination rates, high Delta exposure, and are confident right now and perhaps overconfident because their prevalence has declined. And that describes a lot of states in the South right now, which I think could be vulnerable to Omicron.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
CNBC has quick and easy to understand business news updates at the open, midday, and close every weekday. Markets, money, and more from Wall Street to Main Street. I'm CNBC's Jessica Ettinger. Follow and listen to CNBC Business News Updates wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Squawk Pod. Here's Andrew Ross Sorkin.
Got an update now on the Omicron variant of the coronavirus. Yesterday, Georgia became the 17th U.S. state to confirm a case. Meg Terrell joins us with the latest. Lots of news to update us with over the weekend, Meg.
Yeah, Andrew. So in the U.S., of course, more cases reported in multiple states. We are learning a little bit more about the characteristics of this variant and of these cases. Some of them are travel related, folks having been to southern Africa. Others are community spread. Most of them so far reported to be mild, a mixture of vaccinated and unvaccinated folks. We did hear about one case in New Jersey where the person was fully vaccinated, sought emergency department care, but we do not know the extent of that, and some pointing out that could just be a typical breakthrough case. It was said that she had moderate symptoms. But something catching a lot of attention over the weekend, guys, was a report out of South Africa from a regional hospital system there looking at the severity of cases. The authors of this report saying it is really starkly different at the beginning of this fourth wave there than it has been from previous waves. While we have seen hospital admissions tick up, they report that a majority of these admissions are for diagnoses unrelated to COVID. They have a policy there of testing everybody in the hospital for COVID. And so it seems like a lot of people are there and then they turn out to have COVID. They didn't realize that they did. Many fewer of these patients require oxygen in the hospital. And they report that the COVID-related hospitalizations, the stays there are a lot shorter, 2.5 days compared with 8.5 for the previous 18 months. Now, this is also from the same report. They look at the deaths from COVID and they have not yet seen them tick up. Deaths have not yet increased there. But guys, a lot of caveats to this. Deaths and severe disease both lag by several weeks. So we could just be seeing the early data and not yet seeing severe disease manifest. We are also seeing a lot more younger patients going into the hospital in South Africa. And so, of course, we know that age is related with more severe disease as well. Older people are more vaccinated in South Africa, but perhaps a glimmer of positive news if this trend holds. Guys.
Hey, Meg, can we talk about transmission? Because there was also two other, and again, all anecdotal, but a party that took place, as I think you know, in Oslo, where effectively 120 people got it, including some that weren't even part of the party who happened to go into the same room as the party like an hour after the party was over, which to some doctors seems to suggest it really does hang in the air and has an almost measles-like quality to from a transmissibility perspective. Similar story, there was a party in Denmark where 150 people seemed to have gotten it all at the same time.
Yeah, these are really scary things to hear about, the number of people just getting infected, these super spreader events, some of the world's first with Omicron. We just don't know yet if it really is that much more transmissible. The things that seem more firm are that it can reinfect people who've previously had COVID more easily. Some folks are now talking about whether the time from infection to infectiousness is shorter with Omicron, which would make it more contagious in that way. But more work is needed to be done on all of this. And I don't think even all of those cases have been sequenced. So we don't know that they're all Omicron. You know, the expectation is many of them probably are. But it's, of course, very frightening to hear about that level of contagiousness, if that is the case.
And then in terms of severity, one of the big questions, especially around some of the data out of South Africa, had been that it wasn't affecting older people, and we hadn't seen it in enough people for a long enough time to know whether we were going to get, unfortunately, to either hospitalizations or death or the like. Are we now at a point where we can, I mean, either are we at that point, or when will we be at the point to actually be able to measure this properly?
Yeah, we're still only really in the first few weeks of this wave, which is just remarkable to see how quickly the cases have gone up. So it will probably still be a few more weeks until we really see that. There's also a marked difference in the vaccination rates among people over 50 and under 50 in South Africa. And so perhaps that is playing a role here. And if so, does it show that the vaccines do provide protection, which is something that we all really want to see? We are expecting perhaps even as soon as the end of this week, we could see the first lab data on how well the vaccines protect or at least neutralize the Omicron variant. And from there, we'll start to hear more about the decision making around whether we'll need updated vaccines. But of course, we just keep hearing it'll be a few more weeks and we're all really impatient to know these answers.
Meg Terrell with the latest. Always great to see you, and thank you for everything. Appreciate it. Joe?
I've got a couple of things, you guys. I still go between Omicron and Omicron. Both are acceptable in the dictionary. But if you think about it, it's Omega. That's
right.
The big
but
O.
It's
and
Omni.
So it would be Omicron. And micron is a word that's used a lot. And it's actually is little O and big O. It's now big O to me is Oscar Robertson, the great Bearcat University of Cincinnati player. But
I think O. Henry.
We skipped two letters too. We skipped the 13th letter.
We new, skipped new and
we didn't want to say the new variant because that's confusing. And we skipped the next one, which is pronounced Xi, like xylophone.
Right, but it's
so we could have done Xi, but it's spelled she.
Yeah.
Xi, like so we had to, you know, no.
Who said they did it because it was a common surname and they didn't want to pick it up.
Exactly.
In China,
but it's pronounced
the first
Xi
100,
anyway.
It's one of the top 200. It's maybe like the top 200 surnames in China. The top 100 surnames in China cover 85% of the population.
Yeah. But it's little O and big O, and it's used a lot for the 15th of something, like the 15th star in a constellation.
I've been sticking with Omicron, but I confuse myself.
I'm with like Omicron. I might start doing it, because that's acceptable,
I'm thinking
too.
Then it sounds like a tech company.
You're thinking Om. You do that. You used to do that,
right.
Sorkin. You used to do that, but you stopped. You told me you used to do that in the morning.
Transcendental meditation.
The producer's laughing at that.
You do it.
You know what?
That's what
your
I used
mood,
to do.
I look at your mood ring, and a lot of times I see it just angry purple. And when you used to do ohms, you were much. You
not
just
a mood
seemed like
ring. It doesn't change colors.
You think I was better?
No.
I'll give you my number today. My readiness, Joe. I'm doing today. I should be 89%, or not 89. My number. I got an 89 this morning.
That's
good.
That's pretty good. That's pretty good. That's good. That's good for all of us. Right, Beck? That's good for
all of us.
Yep. The Omicron variant spreading through the U.S. I'm going to just mix it up, use all the different pronunciations, with dozens of cases found in 17 states, according to the CDC director. And joining us now, Dr. Scott Gottlieb, former FDA commissioner, a CNBC contributor. He also serves on the boards of Pfizer and Illumina. Some good stuff happened recently, Scott. It just regulators sort of conceding that, we may do a expedited approach in terms of if we need to actually have a vaccine that's more customized towards
Omicron will do that. That was probably good. I'd like you to comment on what you know about the sequences that were added and the similarity to the common cold, which is a coronavirus. It makes it more transmissible, but at the same time, it makes the symptoms milder potentially. Why do we think that? And is it, do we have any real evidence to think that, or we're just hopeful?
Yeah, I would be careful about overinterpreting that sequence data. I don't think you can just impute from what you see in the sequence what the clinical characteristics are going to be. I think more important is the clinical data on the ground. And unfortunately, we're really challenged collecting that in the setting of a current crisis. I mean, the South Africans are busy delivering crisis levels of care. So as we saw in New York, it's very hard for busy clinicians in the setting of a crisis to both collect information and publish it and deal with the immediate patient care issues. And this is where the WHO, I think, could be doing much more on the ground to help assist in collecting that clinical information and disseminating it, analyzing it, so we can have some clinical insights. Now, that said, the doctors in South Africa are doing, you know, very good work and putting out some clinical data. We had a report over the weekend from a hospital in Tshwane district, which is a busy part of Pretoria that's hard hit by this new variant, or perceived to be hard hit by this new variant. That was somewhat encouraging. It showed that of 166 patients who were admitted to the hospital since this crisis began, they found 38 COVID positive patients. Most were incidental findings, people who were there for obstetrical reasons or surgery and found to be COVID positive but not symptomatic. Of the 9 patients with COVID pneumonia, most seemed to be stable, none were in critical care, and all had been unvaccinated. So there's some indication that the vaccines may be protective, and also that people who are getting sick aren't getting as sick. Now, the critical question is going to be, and this is the one we need to tease out and could be teasing out with better data collection by the international bodies, the critical question is going to be, are people getting less ill because they've previously been infected with Delta? We know there was a very high attack rate of Delta in that part of South Africa. Or is this an innately less virulent virus? We don't know the answer to that question. I think our assumption has to be that people are getting less ill because they've been previously exposed to COVID and therefore have residual cellular immunity, their B cells, memory B cells and T cells. So they're able to fight off the disease even if they're susceptible to the infection.
Let's try. It's a moving target. Let's try to anticipate where what we should be concerned with. We had Thanksgiving, a lot of people. There's still a lot of unvaccinated individuals and some breakthrough. Is Delta, because it is a bad variant, really bad, more transmissible and make people really sick, are we going to need to have our eye on Delta breakouts still, or do you think we should be worrying about the spread of this new variant?
Yeah, Omicron isn't here in any appreciable level. There's not a widespread community transmission of this virus now at all. And so their absolute risk of contracting is exceedingly low in the United States. And we have good detection, so we would be picking it up. Delta's the immediate risk. And the tragic thing is there is a lot of people who are going to get infected with Delta even still. And they may find that that immunity that they've acquired through that Delta infection isn't going to be protective against Omicron. So, you know, based on what we know now, we'll know more in a couple of weeks. But based on what we know now, the vaccines still appear to be protective against both Delta and this new variant. And so there's still a window for people to both get boosted and get vaccinated. And probably getting more people vaccinated, if this does end up spreading here, could become much more important. I worry about states that have low vaccination rates, high Delta exposure, and are confident right now, and perhaps overconfident because their prevalence has declined. And that describes a lot of states in the South right now, which I think could be vulnerable to Omicron because they're relying a lot on Delta immunity. They've seen prevalence really collapse because of that Delta immunity, because they've had such a big wave of infection. But Omicron seems to pierce that. We have clear evidence now that the people who are getting infected in South Africa are people who are getting reinfected after a Delta infection. So far, we haven't seen analytical work on the vaccines. That should be coming. So we'll have a better sense how well 2 doses of vaccine, which is largely what's been used in this market, is protecting against this new variant. And then we're going to have to look at the neutralization data and see if there's a delta between the 3 doses and the 2 doses. I suspect there will be, and that the 3 doses is going to provide more robust protection against this.
So like a booster, if you're boosted recently, then you might even have asymptomatic but still spread Omicron.
Yeah, I think, you know, if I had to put a marker down, I think that you're going to find that the vaccines, even a properly boosted vaccines, isn't nearly as protective against infection from this new variant as it is against Delta and some of the variants that we've seen to date. But it is much more protective against symptomatic disease and very protective against severe disease. That's what we hope would be the outcome here. I think there's going to be clear evidence that it pierces the immediate immunity, so people are more likely to get infected, but then not become either symptomatic or as severely ill. And so the vaccines will be fulfilling their original premise. We'll see. Again, these are answerable questions, and I think world health bodies really need to be doing more in these parts of the world, trying to assist in data collection and the analytical work to get answers to these questions, because we're at a point right now where even weeks matters. We have to make decisions about pivoting over production for the global community. And so the WHO and others could be on the ground collecting information. A senior WHO official tweeted out this morning imploring countries to submit data to their database. That's kind of passive. I mean, we should be doing more active collection on the ground and assisting the doctors in that region.
Okay, Dr. Scott Gottlieb, thanks. Today's Monday.
Thanks a lot.
Expect to see you again soon. Thank you.
Next on Squawk Pod, Talking Tacos.
Jack in the Box had a darn good taco.
And BuzzFeed going public today, but an unusually high number of investors have pulled their cash from the SPAC. What's buzzing about this deal? The digital media company's CEO, Jonah Peretti, joins us.
In the midst of our process, we definitely saw the SPAC market get ice cold. We anticipated high redemptions, and we structured a deal so that we knew we could get public and buy Complex regardless of the redemption levels.
CNBC has quick and easy to understand business news updates at the open, midday, and close every weekday. Markets, money, and more from Wall Street to Main Street. I'm CNBC's Jessica Ettinger. Follow and listen to CNBC Business News Updates wherever you get your podcasts.
Uptrack, stand by Joe.
You're listening to Squawk Pod.
Good morning and welcome back to Squawk Box here on CNBC Live from the NASDAQ market site in Times Square. I warned you guys, does Monday not come fast compared to Friday? Was that not unbelievable?
Time flies. Remember, when you're having fun.
I said enjoy the anticipation of the weekend because it's basically already Monday on Friday.
Well, then this should be your favorite day of the week because Friday is coming.
I'm trying to figure it out. I'm trying to be happy all the time, which is we all need to try that. I'm Joe Kernel along with Becky Quick and Andrew Ross Sorkin. I succeed most of the time.
And new in the past few minutes, Jack in the Box is buying Mexican food chain Del Taco for about $575 million, including debt. Jack in the Box says that with the deal, it would control about 2,800 restaurants across the United States. And notably, it says 99% of Del Taco restaurants have a drive-thru. Not a bad bet during the continuing pandemic. The drive-thrus have been the busy places. Joe?
That is huge. That is huge news. And I just immediately wondered about, you know, Jack in the Box had a darn good taco. And I'm just wondering what that means.
Synergies.
Do they merge the taco operations for cost saving? No. So Jack in the Box will continue.
Maybe sourcing operations.
I love both of those chains. I got to tell you, and we don't have them back here. I love both of them. I mean, I'm thinking about what I got at each one of those right now. What a great deal! Thank you for bringing that to me and the viewers.
Anytime.
Big story today. BuzzFeed set to go public today via SPAC amid some drama over investor redemptions and a dispute with employees. Leslie Picker joins us now with more. Leslie.
Hey, Andrew. That's right. BuzzFeed set to make its debut after merging with a SPAC where 98% of shareholders supported the deal. That doesn't mean investors and BuzzFeed employees are happy about it. A mere $16 million remains in a trust after 94% of shareholders redeemed from the SPAC, known as 890 Fifth Avenue Partners. The name apparently comes from the address of the Avengers headquarters in the Marvel comic. The redemption option leaves BuzzFeed with just a fraction of the cash it was expecting from the transaction, although the company will have gross proceeds of about $150 million from convertible notes in connection with this merger. Now, the redemption proportion is the highest for any SPAC in the fourth quarter and more than double this year's average rate of 42%. While shareholders were casting their ballots last week, the BuzzFeed News Union walked off the job for about 24 hours. Union representatives in a tweet say they've been bargaining for contracts for 2 years and are seeking more than the 1% guaranteed annual raise and $50,000 salary floor. A spokesman for BuzzFeed telling CNBC in response, quote, there's a bargaining session planned for Tuesday, which will be tomorrow, where we look forward to making more progress with the union. Before then, the company is about to achieve an incredible milestone, becoming the first publicly traded digital media company with complex networks in our ranks and equity for more deals ahead. NBC Universal, the parent company of CNBC, is an investor in BuzzFeed. As he mentioned, as the spokesperson mentioned, today's debut will be closely watched as a proxy for public investor interest in digital media companies. Andrew.
It's quite the story, Leslie, and we're going to be speaking just a little bit with BuzzFeed's founder, Jonah Peretti. But how much do you think that this is a signal, if you will, for the rest of the market?
Yeah, I mean, I think the redemption numbers are certainly something that people will have to consider when they choose the SPAC route. If you're going into this thinking that you're going to get somewhere closer to a $288 million, that's how much the SPAC raised in the first place. And at the end of the day, you're ending up with about $16 million. You might say, hey, if I had gone the traditional IPO route, maybe I would have had more cash on hand as a result of this deal. Or if I would have just in a regular way M&A transaction, I would have had more cash on hand as a result of this merger. So I think it definitely changes the calculus for a lot of companies. Now, not every company is going to be in this situation. As I mentioned, these redemption levels, 94% redemption levels, that's the highest of the fourth quarter, more than double the average of this year. So it's definitely not the norm, but it's not unheard of as well. This is something that people need to realize is a possibility.
Hey, Leslie, real quick, and maybe just explain it to the audience, because I'm not sure everybody totally always understands. When an investor invests in a SPAC before the de-SPACing, not only can they get their money back, mm-hmm. but they can get their money back with interest. So when you see a big investor group go into a SPAC early, it's not clear that that unto itself is some signal that they support the deal, if you will, or they support what's about to happen next.
That's right. So there are two things that you can do with a SPAC. And what's interesting here is, of course, as I mentioned, this deal got overwhelming shareholder support. 98% of shareholders voted in favor of the deal. That's because they have a way better option. If you're an investor here, you can choose to redeem at the $10 IPO price if you so choose to, while supporting the deal. You don't really care because you're getting your money back, as you mentioned, with interest. So just because a deal has tremendous support, which almost invariably these deals do, doesn't mean you can't redeem. It doesn't mean you won't redeem. And a lot of that has to do with kind of where the shares are trading at this point in time. It was trading well below those $10 on Friday as well. And so that makes it more attractive to redeem if you can get your money back at a higher price than where it's trading in the market. That has a certain calculus to it. But then also, if you get the sense in the market that other people are going to redeem as well, and the stock could fall on its listing day, that may be another reason to redeem before the merger actually takes place.
Leslie Picker, thanks for breaking it down.
Thanks.
BuzzFeed going public today on the NASDAQ through a business combination with 890 Fifth Avenue Partners. It's a SPAC, and the deal includes an acquisition of Complex Networks for $300 million. NBC Universal, an investor in BuzzFeed. Joining us right now, first on CNBC, is BuzzFeed founder and CEO Jonah Peretti. Jonah, it's great to see you. Congratulations on this milestone. So many questions about what you're going to do next, but also about the transaction itself, as you know, given the headlines around it. You're raising about $16 million in equity. On top of that, there's that convertible note, which brings you up over $100 million on top of that, or more than that, actually. But I'm curious, as you think about SPACs today and you think about this transaction, whether if you could do it all over again, you would still do it this way, which is to say, would you go off and do an M&A transaction or try to raise $16 million through the private markets?
Yeah, thanks for having me, Andrew. So I'm not, an expert on SPACs or invested in any particular vehicle. The thing that was so great about the SPAC transaction is it allowed us to go public and do an acquisition at the same time. And that's why the vehicle was really attractive to us. Digital media has really struggled to consolidate and get operating leverage because private-to-private transactions are really difficult. And so what the SPAC transaction let us do is add Complex, get public, have a public currency. And so we're very excited about the transaction and being able to become a public company today.
So now that you're a public company, tell us what therefore comes next.
So We're going to continue to grow our business. We're going to continue to look for attractive acquisition targets with BuzzFeed, Complex, HuffPost, Tasty. We're bringing together the best brands in digital media, and we really are excited about being the pioneering company in digital media that will, you know, be the comp for other players in the space and really show that digital media can be a strong business. And we reach so many millennial and Gen Z consumers that are just very hard to reach other ways. And it's, I think, a really exciting time where digital media is growing and becoming a really excellent business.
In terms of the path to profitability, the business still does lose money. What does it look like?
We were EBITDA profitable last year. We'll be EBITDA profitable this year, significantly more than last year. I think there's a great path for profitability in this space, and we've been able to achieve that. Looking at the kind of operating leverage you get also as companies get bigger, it's something that digital media has been lacking with a lot of smaller players. With more scale, you have the ability to invest in commerce, invest in advertising, invest in technology, and really build the platform, a modern platform for media.
Right. But speak then to the idea of investment. I think part of this whole transaction was around raising a ton of cash so that you could go make some of those investments, so you could hire personnel and such. And clearly, the amount of money you were able to raise in the end was not what I think people imagined when you began.
We raised enough cash to operate our business and acquire Complex. We'll have a public currency in a public stock. And operating with fiscal discipline is really important. Having a lot of cash would be nice. But it's important to use your cash in a way that where you really are understanding the inputs and outputs of your business and right, investing wisely. And we've been able to do that, and being able to have a business that generates cash is more important than just raising a ton of cash.
But Jonah, we've known each other for quite some time. What did you think when you saw the redemptions? You had to think something.
We entered a SPAC market that was very hot, where even companies that were not very good companies were raising at very high valuations and raising a lot of cash. We have just this year, not 3-4 years out, we have over $500 million in revenue. So we're a real business that could have taken a traditional IPO path. In the midst of our process, we definitely saw the SPAC market get ice cold. And so we anticipated high redemptions, and we structured a deal so that we knew we could get public and buy Complex regardless of the redemption levels. So we really anticipated this because we saw what was happening in the market, and feel really excited about Complex joining us and being public today.
When you talk about other acquisitions and using this as a currency, what kinds of businesses would you want to acquire?
So if you look at what the last two deals we've done, HuffPost, really well-known brand, really engaged audience. It's already from losing money last year, it's already contributing to our profitability this year. So that was a great one for us. Complex is another really strong brand in sneakers, in music and food and lifestyle. Adds a male skewed demographic to the company. So that's another example. So if you want to think about what we're looking for in the future, it's really strong brands, really engaged audiences, great new monetization opportunities, and the ability to have more operating leverage as a bigger company with some shared services.
But more, just to put a fine point, more advertising driven, more e-commerce driven, more subscription driven.
The real key to our success has been having diversified revenue. So BuzzFeed is a commerce business, an advertising business, a content business. And when we buy a new company, we're able to extend those business lines to that business and make it a stronger, more diversified business.
Jonah Peretti, we look forward to following you now as a publicly traded company. Thanks for joining us this morning.
That is Squawk Pod for today. Thanks for listening. Squawk Box is hosted by Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Tune in weekday mornings on CNBC at 6 Eastern. Follow Squawk Pod wherever you get your podcasts. We've got all the news you need from our 3-hour morning show, and then some.
I might like Omicron. I might start doing it because that's acceptable,
too. I'm thinking Om.
Then it sounds like a tech company.
You're thinking Om. You do that. You used to do that.
We'll meet you back here tomorrow.
We are...
are clear. Thanks, guys.
CNBC has quick and easy to understand business news updates at the open, midday, and close every weekday. Markets, money, and more from Wall Street to Main Street. I'm CNBC's Jessica Ettinger. Follow and listen to CNBC Business News Updates wherever you get your podcasts.